due to scheduling conflicts, today's edition of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair was pre-recorded.
Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, my first guest today is no stranger to theology. The New York Times wrote, "To millions of evangelical Christians, the Schaefer name is royal, and Frank is the reluctant, wayward, traitorous prince. His crime is not financial profligacy like some pastors' sons, but turning his back on Christian conservatives." And coming later in today's show, "It doesn't matter if you are 5, 15, or even 50, says Paul Smith, "we're never too old to learn from a good story." And I, too, believe in the power of story. Paul Smith is the author of Parenting with a Story, Real Life Lessons in Character for Parents and Children to Share. We'll hear from him in the second half of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to introduce my first guest. We sat down and did a pre-recorded interview. You're hearing this for the first time. His name is Frank Schaefer. He's a best-selling author, a movie director, blogger, speaker, fine artist, father of three, proud grandfather of five, and a survivor of polio. He's appeared on Oprah, Fresh Air with Terry Gross, The Today Show, Rachel Maddow, and many other media shows. And the name of his new book is called Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God: How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And we begin this interview with me asking him, I'd heard him speak, and he said the book title was deliberately provocative, and here's why.
Well, you know, the subtitle is How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And I guess when you put the two together, what I'm trying to say is, do labels really work? And the provocative part of the title, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, is to get away from these easy labels that we give ourselves to kind of identify with a group and really try to dig below the surface and say, hey, listen, you know, if you and I were sitting on a desert island and we had just washed up there and, you know, if we were lucky enough to have a couple of cases of beer, so our conversation would be relaxed and honest after a drink or two, would we really be holding fast to belief and unbelief, black, white, male, female, gay, straight, atheist or agnostic, or would we get beyond that and say, hey, you know what really makes me tick here? And let's admit something, and that is we're all ambivalent, we're all on a journey, we all live within all kinds of paradoxes in our life. So I think the message of the title, other than trying to make people interested in the book, is to put what seem like contradictions together, but to do so in a way that later in the book I can unpack and say, hey, listen, what this is about is a journey. Take me, for instance. I grew up in a fundamentalist evangelical family. That was years ago. I became my father's nepotistic sidekick in the evangelical religious right. Today, I'm known as a liberal blogger on Huffington Post, an Obama supporter. I'm a grandfather rather than being a teenage father the way I was when I was a kid. My life has completely changed. I'm a different person. Imagine if I was trying to wear the mantle of a label and stick with correct belief, be that atheist or Christian or Buddhist or Hindu. How would that fit with the journey of my life? So I think one problem is we put these things of religion and philosophy and politics in special categories, and really they're just part of real life. And so, for instance, take another word. Take love, for instance. You know, you could write a book. I've been married to Jeannie for 44 years, and here we are. We're grandparents now. But you could write a book about our life together, and you could put something in the title like, how I've stayed married 44 years while both hating and loving my wife. And people would say, how could you do that? Well, then they've obviously never been in a relationship, because sometimes love means that you come back after a fight and apologize and hate your partner a little less. Other times it means you bring the woman you love or the man you love a cup of coffee in bed. Other times it's about sex. Other times it's about putting your own interests aside so that you can function as a couple. It means all those things. So imagine if you were stuck with one definition of love or one definition of belief or one definition of faith. That's why the title is deliberately provocative and contradictory. And I think I follow through in the book and explain that a little bit.
Yes, you do. And the how of giving love, the how of creating beauty, the how of finding peace. And I know in the book you say you have not found peace, but you find it by embracing that paradox.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at paradox or contradiction through the eyes of what I call certainty addicts. Look, you know, we live in a day and age when people want answers and they want them fast and they want them easy. And, you know, just as neuropsychologists tell us that you can retrain your brain by wearing spectacles that show everything upside down or watching a lot of stuff on a screen and never relating to the real world around you in a tactile connection, people actually grow their brains. We used to think these were just all psychological matters. Now we know that the neural pathways actually transform physically. For instance, children who grew up listening to classical music have different shaped brains than people who don't, and so forth and so on. I think, you know, if you come from a fundamentalist background of any sort, you know, if your father or mother was a dedicated atheist and raised you to be one as if somehow this was a belief system you had to hang on to out of loyalty to your family, or an evangelical background like the one I come from, it shapes your brain in a certain way. So you hinge your life and your meaning on these kind of answers that you've been given or spoon-fed or adopted or grown into, whatever. And to move away from that is scary because it leaves you without parameters. So things like doubt and paradox, ambivalence, uncertainty look like enemies of peace. Actually, as I argue in the book, what I'm talking about and why I'm an atheist who believes in God is that, in fact, my own sense of peace, when I do have it, comes from embracing paradox not as a second best, but as a reflection of the way things actually are. So I'll give you an example that comes from the book, but I think it sums it up. Look, we are biological machines. We are an eye blink away, geologically speaking, from being single-celled creatures swimming around in the mud somewhere. We just came out of the trees and developed enough consciousness to have empathy, and that empathy makes us uncomfortable because we're also got evolutionary brains that tell us to do everything on the order of survival, and so there are these contradictions. And so we're wandering around here as biological machines, but we're looking at the world through a pair of what I'll call spiritual eyes that look for meaning, that look for beauty, that look for love, empathy. I mean, think of this. Think of the irony that evolution prepared us merely for survival, and yet here we are, we're the kind of primates that sit down and have long, detailed, even furious arguments about things like music and art. Totally abstract concepts that have nothing to do with what we need and yet that we can feel passionate about. So obviously something's going on in human evolution that can't be summed up by simply studying the sum of our parts. So sure, brain chemistry explains the brain. It explains altruism and our concept of beauty. Nevertheless, those things give us this sense of spiritual meaning, as I say in the book, sort of this offstage voice we hear, as it were. And rather than trying to resolve that and say, okay, I believe in God, or I'm an atheist and I'll try to explain everything through science, why don't we just deal with this duality, this sort of split personality we have, not just in one area of spirit, but also art or love or any of these things, and instead say, hey, that's just the way things are. That is the paradox of our being, and where we are on the evolutionary path is not in a place where we can stand up on our little hind legs, having just fallen out of the trees, and make vast cosmological pronouncements, much less make enemies on the basis of the people who don't agree with those pronouncements, when we can barely function enough to grow food and take care of our planet that we're running into the ground with our climate change and all the rest of it. So I just think it's a matter of hubris and a kind of a human primate arrogance to think that, for instance, all our problems come from religion. If everybody was an atheist, it would be better. Or all our problems come from atheists who don't believe in God, and if they believed, we would be more moral. No, we wouldn't. Our problem is we're semi-evolved primates, and we have this contradictory personality of both spirituality and biology coexisting. It makes us very uncomfortable.
Right.
And rather than try to resolve it, let's just accept it.
Right. And from everything I've read about you and watched videos and listened to you talk, it's the fundamentalist aspect of it, the extreme aspect of whether you're an atheist, agnostic, I've heard you say, for example, that you used to be intimidated by atheists and agnostics as a writer because you felt they were more intellectual until you started receiving fundamentalist stuff from them too.
Right. Exactly. And you know, the thing is, let's all admit something, whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or a Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, evangelical, Roman Catholic, progressive, you know, you name it, let's admit something. Back off for a minute and admit this. It's not a question of belief based on fact. It's a question of circumstances. I mean, take the conversation you and I are having now. You know, I know from your accent you grew up in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Switzerland, but I moved to America in 1980. But we are citizens of Western culture. We came out of the 20th and 21st centuries. All right. If we had been born in 10th century China, no matter what books we had read, if we were even literate, we would not be having this conversation. If we had been born in 15th century Riyadh and were the son and daughter of an imam, we would not be having this conversation. So the first thing to do is to say, hey, listen, if you're Richard Dawkins or Frank Schaeffer or, you know, Pat Robertson or President Obama or Hillary Clinton, whatever you think you stand for and believe, please don't argue it on the basis that somehow this is revealed truth that you have absolute certainty about, as if somehow no matter where you were born or in what time and place, you would have been smart enough to come to these conclusions and everybody else is an idiot. If we're not idiots in some field, it's simply because of the luck of where we were born. And I think, you know, as the future progresses, people will look at our era just as we look back at the Middle Ages and other eras, and we pick and choose. We take what we want from those things, the art they produce, the architecture. We leave behind the witch burning or whatever it may be. So my point is exactly what you just said. I reject the extremism and the certainty addiction of anybody who puts forward a philosophical or theological position in which they judge other people, not on the basis of the content of their character, but on the basis of correct belief. And the emails I get from the atheist community, for instance, who don't like the fact that I'm using their word, atheist, in a title that also includes God, remind me very much of the same emails I get from evangelicals, who say, we're so sad that you are not one of us. How can you use our word God in a title combined with atheism, as if somehow these terms are truth terms that are owned by one party or another, and each in its own way puts on a heresy trial if you use them wrong? And I'm saying, hey, listen, let's back off. These are all just metaphors for incomplete thoughts. We can never complete them. Correct belief never got anybody anywhere. It can never be correct because we either lack the knowledge or the sincerity. It's never there. Let's instead talk about the content of people's character. And, you know, I think we all would do better if we would stick with that and have these discussions based on what contributes to the content of the character growth of people around us and ourselves so we and they become the kind of people you'd like to be stuck on a desert island with, instead of jerks who write you off because you don't believe what they believe.
Yeah. So I want to look a little, Frank, about how you grew up, because you mentioned you grew up in Switzerland. Your father, I believe it's true to say, was known as the architect who put the religious right in politics.
Right.
At what point, I mean, you obviously grew up in a very religious background, entrenched in this day in, day out. But there was a point when you started to break away from this. What happened?
Well, you know, thumbnail history. I'm 62 years old. I was born in 1952, and I grew up in Switzerland. My parents were both American missionaries, very humble, very obscure people. No one knew about them. We ate mostly cheese and macaroni casseroles and salad and bread when I grew up. Literally, my mother didn't have a budget for meat. And then all of a sudden, this open community, they were sort of running a hippie commune on evangelical lines, crazy as that sounds, people sleeping in sleeping bags, hitchhikers who were on their way to India to ashrams during the era of the early 60s, for instance, stopping by for a night, then staying a month or two in a work-study program with my parents. You know, people gave donations, this kind of thing. Then in my early teen years, Dad started to write books, and they were published in the UK and in the States, and he became very famous within what I'll call the thinking circles of evangelical Christianity in the colleges and the more upscale churches, but still not terribly well known to anyone else. And then evangelical leaders like Billy Graham and others began to come by, and then sometimes even people in politics like some of the folks from the Bush family came by. And so we began to see better known people around the table. And then my dad was invited to more and more evangelical venues to speak. And then I made a film series in a kind of a nepotistic evangelical tradition of becoming your father's sidekick when I was in my late teens and early 20s, called How Should We Then Live, which was his take on history and culture. And that became a kind of a classic within the evangelical world. Literally millions of people saw it. And then we got into the evangelical pro-life movement, the anti-abortion movement, after mid-1970s, with a project called Whatever Happened to the Human Race that also featured C. Everett Koop, who became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General. By the time that was all done, and that seminar tour was all done, Dad was a household name in evangelical circles. I mean, all evangelical circles. And we were on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson and with Dr. Dobson on Focus on the Family, on and on and on and on. I was flying around the country in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet. In fact, I even gave the keynote speech when I was, I think, 26 years old to the Southern Baptist Convention. Then my dad died in 1984, and when he did, you know, I sat down and had a real rethink, just starting with the fact that the evangelical right-wing fundamentalist movement we were now part of was just so ugly. It was beginning to be homophobic and gay-bashing. It was certainly anti-feminist. And I was interested in art, painting. You know, people can go online to frankschaeferart.com and see that I'm a painter. And I was interested in writing and movie making. And so essentially, just on aesthetic level, as well as philosophically, I began to drift away. And of course, once you start asking questions about a fundamentalist, watertight, circular argument, you begin to say, okay, look, I want some outside verification. I don't care just what the next Bible verse says. What does the world say? What does science say? What do other people say? Then, of course, your faith, from the point of view of evangelical fundamentalism, is doomed, because the minute you get outside of the circular talk-to-yourself argument, you begin to go away from it. And so for both aesthetic reasons and for spiritual reasons, philosophical reasons, I drifted away. And by the way, lost my income, because I'd been earning a good income as an evangelical sidekick to my father. So I went out to Hollywood, and I cut a reel, a show reel, out of footage from How Should We Then Live and Whatever Happened to the Human Race, somewhat disingenuously leaving out what I think of as the God bets, and landed myself an agent, and over the next 10 years directed four very forgettable B-movies in Hollywood, but they were real films, I mean, bad as they were. And then towards the end of that process, encouraged by my wife, I wrote a first novel called Portofino, the town in Italy, which then got great reviews. I was very lucky. Became a book that sold well, still in print now, translated into 9 languages, had a simultaneous release in the UK, and had a good following there as well. And I left the film business, which I'd never been terribly good at, and began writing. And that's about a dozen or 15 books or so ago. And some of those books have been on things as far-flung as my experience of being a Marine father. I wrote a book called Keeping Faith, a Father-Son Story about Love in the United States Marine Corps, that I was interviewed by Oprah, and that turned into a bestseller. And then memoirs like Crazy for God, which also sold very well, subtitled How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Live to Take All or Almost All of It Back. And actually, out of the correspondence from that book, including some emails I got from Christopher Hitchens and other new atheist authors, I wrote this book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, really to try to answer my own questions and my internal debate, and share it with the people who are writing to me asking where I was at. You know, everybody from Christopher Hitchens to a lot of evangelicals who were very disappointed that I had left subculture.
Right. I want to ask you about Chris Hitchens, because I've studied a lot of Christopher Hitchens' work. And his response was what when he read your book? Why didn't you join us or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was very friendly. I had a total of 3 phone calls with him, and I think maybe 2 email exchanges. And he first called me because he had read a review of the book, I think in The Nation or somewhere, and he got interested, and we talked a little bit on the phone. He says, you know, I was just going to turn a page or two. Maybe it was lying in somebody's office. But anyway, he got into it and read it and really liked it, gave me the compliment of saying he thought I was a good writer, and then a few weeks later followed up with a with another caller and then an email saying, but I'm very disappointed because I thought this journey would logically conclude with you declaring yourself to be part of our new atheist movement. You know, why are you, why do you still describe yourself as a person of faith? Obviously you're too intelligent. You know, is your brain broken? He didn't use those words. He was very nice.
He's sarcastic
and
too.
And very complimentary. But the interesting thing was, of course, I was getting exactly the same response from my old evangelical cohorts, were saying, well, okay, we understand you told your story and why you left, and yes, evangelicalism is a money-grubbing mess, and yes, it's too politicized, but why couldn't you finish your book with a ringing affirmation of your faith in Jesus? And I said, well, because I don't see things that way. So I started writing what I'll call the same email to some of my atheist and evangelical acquaintances that really, if you changed a word or two, was the same thing. And that is, hey, listen, you know, well, what's wrong with paradox? What's wrong with saying I don't know? What's wrong with saying I hold two things simultaneously that seem to be contradictory?
Yeah.
I feel one emotionally, even though with my head, I most of the time don't think it's true. And, you know, I never got good answers back, and that's where this book comes from. That's what why I'm an atheist who believes in God has that deliberately provocative, contradictory title. It's my kind of, you know, statement, if you like, declaration that I refuse to simply be put in a category, and that, yes, I hold contradictory views. But I go further. I say, so does everyone. They just don't admit it.
I've been talking with Frank Schaefer, the author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
They seem like such a perfect couple. There must be some other explanation.
Why doesn't she just leave?
I don't understand why she puts up with him.
It takes two to argue.
It's not my place to interfere.
If someone you know is a victim of intimate partner abuse, you can give them back their voice.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We live in a wounded world that needs healing, says ecologist, activist, and author of Rewilding Our Hearts, Mark Beckoff. And Reverend Dr. Karen Tate shares insights from some of our greatest luminaries in her new book, Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape Our World. Join us noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, my guest is no stranger to theology or controversy. His new book is called Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And the Washington Post describes his book as a distillation of wisdom. Here's the rest of my conversation with Frank Schaefer. So talking about your writing, Frank, I'd heard that you'd rather be a good food writer. I don't know if you were being facetious there, but you weren't born the son of a great chef. You were born the son of, a very well-known, very influential pastor, of course, Pastor Francis Schaefer.
Right, right.
So why do you write about this? And I just want to read a quote that Jane Smiley said, and tell me if this is why you're doing it, but... she said about your book in the Washington Post, as someone who has made redemption his work, Frank has in fact shown amazing grace. That was Jane Smiley.
Right. Well, hey, she won a Pulitzer Prize, so she must know what she's talking about. As long as she's saying nice things, that is, about me. Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. Look, you know, when I say I'd rather be a food writer, but I'm not the son of a great chef, you know, I don't think I'm the only writer who writes about personal experiences and recycles them as fiction in novels like Portofino and Saving Grandma, or even my wartime novel when my son was in the Marine Corps fighting in Iraq called Baby Jack, where I sort of went through a story about a Marine who gets killed. Thank God my son was not killed, but I could imagine what that would be like. But I drew it from... my experience, and, you know, when people say, well, why are you writing about this if you're trying to get past it and you're uncomfortable with it, you know, you could ask the same thing of Elie Wiesel. I'm not making a comparison between myself and him, but why does he keep going back to the Holocaust and writing about that? Well, I'm not saying my experience in evangelicalism is a counterpart to that, but you can better believe that he would have rather been writing about sumptuous vacations on the Riviera, but that's not what happened to him. So, of course, he revisits that. And my ghosts are all in that closet with me as a child, being told the Bible is literally true, worrying that I'll go to hell if I'm not saved, committing myself to Jesus again and again to try to make sure. You don't get over that. So, of course, it informs my work. And, yes, I take detours. I write books about my Marine son, or I blog on politics. And I, you know, or my support for Barack Obama, and I do commentaries with people like, MSNBC with Rachel Maddow and others on political subjects where they are impacted by religion. But somewhere in the back of my head, I'm still that kid hearing that this is all true and dealing with it. And so, rather, again, in terms of trying to find peace and create beauty and give love and all the rest of it, rather than just run away from all this and slam the door and pretend it's not me, I've instead tried to deal with it by cycling it through my work. That said, right now I'm working on a new book written to my grandchildren, and yes, some of my philosophy will be in it, some of my struggles to give it context, but it's about music and art and love and life and children and the things that make life good. So it's, again, a diversion from this core experience of mine. But you just don't get past it. So I don't think it's anything I've chosen. I just think I'm a writer, and this is what writers do. And when I say I'd rather be a food writer, I mean that literally. If I'd been raised in the kitchen of a two- or three-star Michelin restaurant in Paris or Lyon or somewhere, I would love to be writing about cooking. For a start, I like cooking, but also just because it's less fraught.
Right.
You know, when you write a book about how to run a lovely kitchen or you know, wonderful recipes or you know, what a pastini and brodo or fresh tomato offers you, It's a lot more fun getting emails from people who say that sounds delicious than from people who say you're a heretic, or, you know, you've shamed the evangelical community, or you'll burn in hell. Or from the other side, you know, why don't you join us? You must not be terribly smart, or you would declare yourself an atheist. Now, most of my email, by the way, is very nice, and that includes from people who are former evangelicals, from atheists, from people all over the map, who I think are relieved that someone is not putting everything in black and white, and who honors the paradox and the nuance in real life. And so I can't complain. Most of my reaction is very positive to this book. But
you write about life.
I would have rather had a different background.
Yeah, and you do write about some very controversial subjects. You know, I mean, writing about food. Yes, I don't know too many foodie fundamentalists, But you do write about some very controversial subjects. You write for the Huffington Post. You also write a blog post for patheos.com. In there, you wrote, I just looked at a couple of the blog posts you did there. You say the word evangelical is an embarrassment. Is it time to dump it? You also write that the religious right has spent 7 years lynching President Obama.
Which they have, but yes. You know, and the thing is, people say, especially who read this book and my stories about my grandchildren, and, you know, the tone of Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God is very gentle, and it's narrative-driven, it's genuine literary nonfiction, and people like Jane Smiley like my work, blah, blah, blah. But blogging is the equivalent of cage fighting, and I've been in the arena. And I'm not saying I like it or don't like it, I'm just saying it's apples and oranges. So I think there'd be a good argument against doing it at all, but once you step into the blog arena, just like when you step into the Twitter arena, there are certain rules in terms of the length of your sentence. Well, similarly, when you're going to roll your sleeves up and talk about the Tea Party evangelical reaction to Barack Obama, you know, this is not softball. This is a hardball arena, and I play in that arena as a blogger, and it's a very different kind of writing. But it's not unique to our era. You know, I just happen to be reading the biography of John Adams right now, one of our founding fathers. And when you read the quotes from the pamphleteering by people like Thomas Paine and others at that period, you know, you realize that the blogging is a technical term we use for the internet, but pamphleteering with an agenda and with no holds barred is a long and venerable American pastime. Well, not just American, it goes into the Anglo-Saxon culture in general and France as well. So, yeah, when it gets into politics, I roll my sleeves up and play for keeps. And that could be right or wrong, but it's different than the box.
Yeah. So you've mentioned your grandchildren several times. You mentioned them a lot throughout the book. And one of my questions was going to be, in one sentence, what do you tell your grandchildren about religion? And I know you just said you're writing a whole book on that subject, so...
Yeah, I am writing a whole book on it. But short answer is I read them Bible stories. I also read them Greek mythology. I also read them Winnie the Pooh. I also read them other stories. And I don't sit there telling them, now, listen, if you don't believe this is true, you know, you're lost. And if they say, did this really happen? I say a lot of the time, hey, I don't know. There's a long history there, but who knows? And so I am not passing on to them the theological spin that goes with the biblical narrative. So when I take them to church, for instance, I go to a Greek Orthodox church, I like Byzantine liturgy, I'm not sitting there saying, hey, if we don't do this, if we don't believe this, we're lost. The coffee hour, the fellowship, the community, the aspect of the mystery, the exposure to something mysterious that is bigger than ourselves, you know, these are the things that I hope they take away from it. And it doesn't bother me in the least, for instance, that 2 out of 3 of my grown children don't go to church at all. One does. No one's talking about correct belief being a kind of a gate to salvation, as if somehow God burns his children and grandchildren if they get their ideas wrong, if there is a God at all. So to me, you can have the religious experience, the literary value of the biblical narrative and all these other things without passing on this kind of terrifying theological, ideological spin. So basically, my grandchildren love looking at art. Well, you can't look at the art of the West, Fra Angelico's frescoes and all the rest of it that he did in the monasteries in Florence, without looking at angels and demons and gods and all the rest. But they also like looking at Greek mythology. They also look at the Egyptian mummies when I take them to the art museum. And for them, this is all part of the same experience of life and art, literature, story, narrative, make-believe, and the rest. And I don't parse it out for them. I just let the chips fall where they may. Let them make their own conclusions.
Yeah, very good. That's how I was raised, you know, figure it out for yourself. But final question, what do you hope that people will take away from this book? Everybody's going to take away something different. And I have to say, you know, listening to you talk and talking with you right now, I would love to have seen you and Christopher Hitchens have a conversation out there.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I mean, all kidding aside, I was so sad when he got very ill, because obviously then every connection with him stopped. And, you know, if we had been real personal friends, then it would have been a time to be by his side. So this kind of casual communication that I'm sure he carried on with thousands of people, he was a very voracious reader and writer,
yes,
and communicator.
Yeah.
You know, I was just honored to have a few little back and forths with him. But I would have loved for him to hang around a little longer, and then I would have pressed him to meet me when I was down in D.C. or somewhere and bought him a bottle of wine, or from the sounds of one of my editors who was also his editor, it would have been more like a case of wine to spend an evening with him and just kick back and say, hey, let's go for it. You know, let's talk. I would have liked to have done that.
And so what do you hope people will take away from the book?
Well, different people take different things, but what I would love to do is to comfort people who regard themselves as survivors of religion, who yet on the other hand are not comfortable with the kind of born-again experience offered them by the new atheists, where they've got to affirm now yet another set of correct beliefs, and who are willing to live with that paradox of feeling that they have a spiritual longing on one hand and you know, a respect for science and fact on the other, and then rather than try to resolve all this, they would love to be those two people. And I'm saying, well, I'm one of you guys. I get emails from people who say, hey, I'm a lot less lonely now than I read your book. I thought I was the only person thinking this way. So I would like that to cut both ways. I mean, I would love for my atheist friends to read this and say, hey, you know, I mean, aside from what's true or not true, scientifically speaking, this kind of spirituality that allows room for growth and development, changing your mind, backing down, is something I can applaud. And then on the other hand, people who are, you know, have that sense of spiritual longing and feel they've had to make a choice one way or another, feel that they have been they've been comforted, and that it's a bigger world and more beautiful, and that we can concentrate on our individual human relationships and responses to each other as a manifestation of spirituality. That it doesn't have to do with correct belief or theology or being damned or saved.
All labels.
Our relationships.
Right. Well, the book is Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. Frank Schaefer, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And that was a pre-recorded interview I did with Frank Schaefer, again, author of Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And you can find out more about Frank and his work at his website. It's just his name, frankschaefer.com, FrankSchaefer.com. But of course, you can punch in that book title and guarantee it's going to come straight up. Please do stay tuned when we come back. We'll be switching gears a little. We'll be talking with Paul Smith about the power of story. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to BioClean, the people that clean up the mess, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 14th, it's a remote healing Sunday with best practitioner Dr. Nels Rasmussen. We'll celebrate Hanukkah with the Jingle Cats and have open phone lines so you can call in for remote healing for you or your animal friends. Plan to call in early, because due to sports, we'll have a shorter show. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, this week, 9 a.m. to 11:30, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We live in a wounded world that needs healing, says ecologist, activist, and author of Rewilding Our Hearts, Mark Beckoff. And Reverend Dr. Karen Tate shares insights from some of our greatest luminaries in her new book, Voices of the Sacred Feminine. conversations to reshape our world. Join us noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Spread the word. You don't have to settle for the usual talk radio. Now there's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment says, it doesn't matter if you're 5, 15, or 50. Everybody can benefit from the power of story. You can learn from a good story. Paul Smith is the author of Parenting with a Story, Real Life Lessons in Character for Parents and Children to Share. And again, I sat down with Paul and pre-recorded this interview with him. It's based on extensive research into storytelling and, of course, years of experience with his own children. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul Smith. He's a popular keynote speaker and corporate trainer in leadership and storytelling techniques. He's a former executive and 20-year veteran of the Procter & Gamble Company. He's also the author of Lead with a Story. Let me bring you that interview right now. So, Paul, reading the book, I mean, this is for kids, but stories to tell your kids, but I think we can all learn valuable lessons from these stories. And I like the one about your mother-in-law, because I think many people, especially baby boomer age, are going through this kind of experience right now with parents retiring and taking on different roles and everything. And I like the one with your mother-in-law when she was getting panickety on how the turkey had to be carved up.
Yeah, sure. Let me share that. You know, first, let me just mention like where these stories came from. So the idea behind the book is, if we've concluded that sharing stories with kids is going to be a better way to teach them life lessons than just telling them what to think, you know, wouldn't it be great if you had at your disposal 100 or so such stories from people around the world? Because your life alone probably doesn't have enough great stories to teach all the lessons that you want. So what I did was I ended up interviewing about 100 people around the world in probably 20 different countries and all walks of life. And I was looking for what are those unique moments of clarity in their life where they learned an incredible lesson, often an unexpected lesson, about life somehow. And after categorizing all these stories, I ended up with 700 or 800 or 900 stories. And, of course, I could only fit 100 or so in the book. But they all ended up centering around what you might call character traits. So things like humility and ambition and open-mindedness and creativity and curiosity and integrity, but also how we treat other people, humility being one of those, but also kindness and patience and fairness and respect for others. So the one I'll share now is about my mother-in-law, you know, from that chapter on humility. But just so you understand, that's where these aren't all just things from my life. There are two or three in the book from my life, but, you know, the other 97 are from another, you know, 97 people around the world.
No, well, you spent a year putting this together, right?
Oh yeah. So I was probably just a few years into my marriage, and it was a Thanksgiving day, and my wife had prepared, you know, lovely Thanksgiving day meal, and we had a few house guests, including my sister, and of course her mother, and my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, along with a few other people. And I have to admit that, you know, I kind of had that typical mother-in-law, son-in-law relationship with my mother-in-law, a fairly antagonistic one for a while. And so, you know, an hour into the day together, I'd already kind of had enough of her company, and she probably had had enough of mine.
Right.
But what particularly bothered me was, like you said, she just insisted on being the one to carve the turkey, and she had this electronic carving knife, and she just made such a production out of how important it was that the bird had to be cut just so, and you know, one couldn't appreciate a Thanksgiving turkey without just a, you know, properly cut bird, and the thickness had to be just right, and just went on and on about it. And I just, you know, I'd had enough, and I walked outside, and my sister joined me out there, and she could tell, you know, something was bothering me. And as I was telling her about, you know, what was bugging me, she said, you know, something similar, you know, happened to me and our grandfather, whom we called affectionately Ping. And she said, I took care of him the last few years of his life, and he just micromanaged my every move. He told me exactly how to place the mail in the mailbox and lift the flag up, and, you know, exactly how to set the thermostat and what buttons to push. And, you know, I was a 45-year-old woman. I didn't need him telling me how to put the mail in the mailbox. And she said, at one point, it just occurred to me that here's this guy. He's 89 years old. He's worked for literally 8 decades. He quit school in the fourth grade at 8 or 9 years of age to go to work, and he worked for 80 years and just retired. And, you know, he's had a phenomenal career and became a senior leader at the companies he worked at, and he spent a lifetime bossing people around. And now he's retired, and he's ill, and that's why I'm taking care of him. And the truth is, he ended up, you know, dying not too long later. And, you know, in these last few months or years of his life, you know, who am I to take away the one thing that he felt useful doing, which is telling other people how to do their job well, because that's what he spent most of his life doing.
Right, right.
And she said, I just needed to change me. I just need to get over it and let him have that little joy. And I thought she was just commiserating with me, but obviously what she was really doing was drawing an analogy that, you know, I was doing the same thing with my mother-in-law. I was, you know, she had just retired from her 40 or 50-year career of senior leadership jobs, and here she, and she spent her life raising her child, her only child, my wife. And most of the time, she was the one that was cooking Thanksgiving dinner and had guests over and was preparing everything. And here she was, a guest in my home, and didn't have to do anything to prepare the meal. And she just wanted to feel useful for at least 5 minutes during Thanksgiving dinner. And really, who was I to deny her of that?
Right. So I thought that was a great story, because it's something that so many of us face on a daily basis. You know, I did with my mother's illness. When somebody's physically strong and they suddenly become dependent on others, they do want that sense of control, and it's important to them on many levels too. I wanted to talk also about kindness, a chapter on kindness,
yeah.
For a couple of reasons. I think there's a lot of kindness in the world, but it often takes a tragedy to bring out that compassion and kindness. And it would be nice if we saw more of those moments on a daily basis. And also, I've interviewed thousands of people on radio and off radio. And a question I often end with is, what do you wish you'd known 20 years ago? Or how would you have done things differently knowing what you know now? And many, many, many of them have said, I wish I'd been kinder.
Yeah.
So let's begin with a great story in there of the free hugs with Kristen. I love that story.
Yeah, Kristen Pedamonte is just an amazing woman. But she's not who you think she is when you meet her. If you meet her the way many people meet her, and the way that might be is you'd be walking along a street somewhere in New York or Belfast or Jonesboro, Tennessee. She frequents a number of places, and you find her on the street corner holding a cardboard sign. And written in, you know, handwritten in black magic markers. And, you know, some people come up to her and some people don't. You know, it's one of those scenes that you see in thousands of cities every day. It's a very familiar scene. But the difference is that Kristen's cardboard sign isn't asking for money. And it's not, in fact, it's not asking for anything. It's offering something. And her sign simply reads, free hugs. And that's quite literally all she's offering. And she's not, it's not some kind of a ploy to get people, you know, like a, here's a free car wash, you know, and you go and get your car washed, and then of course there's the solicitation to give money at the end of it. It's not like that at all. She doesn't accept money. She's not looking for money. In fact, and it's because she's not homeless. She's not poor. She's a successful artist and actress and storyteller and travels the world. And, you know, she's literally only doing it to add some more joy to the world. And I mean, there have been studies that show that people need 4, 5, or 6, you know, hugs a day in order to be emotionally and mentally healthy. And you don't have to look far to realize that most of us, many of us, are not getting our daily minimum. And that's her role, her goal is to offer free hugs. And it's amazing. People will, like I said, some people just walk by and think it's weird.
Yeah.
And of course. And some people will just watch and just be amazed at what's going on, but still be afraid to come up. But, you know, she's told me one of her favorite and probably most impactful free hugs she gave was to a small boy in Paris. And, you know, this small 5-, 6-, 7-year-old boy had been staring at her for a while, you know, standing there with her mom, and eventually they went on their way. And a few minutes later, this kid comes running back and jumps into the air and leaps into her arms and gives her this big koala bear hug like only, you know, a 5-year-old kid can do. And then mom comes trailing behind, and as Kristen is putting, you know, the boy down, she notices that the mom is crying. And she says, "Oh, my gosh, I'm sorry. Did I do something wrong? I didn't mean to." And the mom says, "Oh, my gosh, no. Everything's fine, but my boy, he's autistic. He doesn't respond well to emotion and right. love and tenderness, and certainly doesn't offer it. In fact, he rarely hugs me or his father. And this is the first time I've seen him hug a stranger. So I'm just thrilled."
Right.
"Somehow brought this out of him."
Right, right. You can just imagine this. So, you know, a lot of people may not come from... I came from generations of great storytellers, I have to say. My grandparents and my parents loved to tell stories. And they were good at it. But somebody might be listening and thinking, you know what, I don't know where to begin. I don't have these great stories, as you said. This is why you compiled your book with some great stories in here. But you say that it's important people don't just read this book. If they read it, they're going to miss the value of it. They have to learn how to use it. So talk to us a little bit about how you've compiled that, if you would.
Yeah, thank you for asking. That's a great question. I think you can certainly learn some things yourself by reading the stories, but if you really want to impact your kids or grandkids or nieces and nephews or whoever you're going to share these stories with, it's important to have a conversation with them about the story after the story's done. You know, and so what I did, I put together call it a discussion guide, and it's a list of 4 or 5 questions for each of the 101 stories in the book, so 400 or 500 questions in the list. But they're tailor-made questions for each of these stories to start you on your way to having a productive discussion with the kids. So it might be things like, and I'll just say it in a generic manner, what did you think about what the main character did in the story? If you had been that main character, would you have done the same thing, or would you have done something different, and why? And it starts what I hope will be a productive conversation, because much of the wisdom that your child garners from this, you know, event in her lives is not just from hearing the story, but from having a conversation with you about it. But it turns out it's also a really neat way to get to know your kids better, and you can learn all kinds of amazing things about them and how they think and what makes them tick and who their friends are at school and what they think. And it's a great conversation starter as well. And that whole thing is a free download that I offer on my website, you know, so if you have the book, it'll make sense to you what the questions are for.
Yeah, lovely. And I wonder if you'd end with the story of you and your father, because I think this is very profound. It's something we hear a lot from elderly people. But I love the way that you told this story in the book, and that's when you had 2 options in life, which, you know, which path do I go? You wrote your father a letter, and he wrote you back saying what?
Yes, so it was quite literally as I was in the process of writing this book, and I was trying to decide whether I wanted to keep my full-time day job, which was not writing books, or did I want to quit that and devote my full-time efforts to writing books and speaking to audiences and things that I do now. And that's quite frankly something that I have a lot of passion for, and I absolutely love doing that. This is my second book, and but it's not the kind of career that offers a lot of financial stability and long-term, you know, and benefits and all that kind of
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
So it was a tough decision, and, you know, I'm married, I've got 2 kids, I got college fund to build, so it was a tough decision. And so I wrote my dad, and I had to write him a letter because he's 80 years old and doesn't hear very well, so I can't have a conversation on the phone with him like I am with you now. And so I wrote him a letter and asked him, and I thought he would just give me some advice. So, you know, 2 weeks later, the response comes back in the mail, and all he did was he told me a story about himself when he was a kid that I'd never heard before. And he said, "Son, you know, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I wanted to be a singer, you know, like Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett. You know, that was his genre." And he said, you know, the first day of the first grade, the teacher asked if any of the students had any special talent. And he said, "I raised my hand, and I said, I can sing." And so, of course, the teacher invited him to stand up and sing a song. And despite the fact that he had never sung in front of an audience before, other than his mother walking around the kitchen where he learned all these songs, he said, "I stood up, and I belted out my favorite song." You know, and he said, "I nailed it. You know, I got all the words and melody right." And he said, before I sat down, the teacher and the other students stood up and they applauded me. You know, and he said, that's the moment that I knew that this is what I was destined to do with my life. And he said, unfortunately, that turned out not just to be the first time, but the last time that I ever sang in front of an audience. And he said, it's been 75 years, and I've regretted it ever since. You know, life just got in the way, and I just, quite frankly, never had the courage to pursue that dream. And he said, someday, son, you're going to wake up, and you're going to be 80 years old like me, and you're not going to have pursued this dream, and it's going to be too late. You know, and he closed the letter by saying, I'd love to see you achieve your dream, but that doesn't mean in your lifetime, son. That means in mine.
Mm, very powerful.
Yeah, I got to tell you, that really motivated me. In fact,
yes.
two days later, I literally walked into my boss's office and quit my 20-year career to pursue this professionally. And you know, I'd already figured out emotionally and rationally this is what I wanted to do, but I lacked the courage, and that story gave me the courage to do it.
Well, thank goodness for storytellers. That's all I can say. That was a great story to end this segment on. The book is chock full of really great stories. And it's called Parenting with a Story, Real Life Lessons in Character for Parents and Children to Share. And I think, you know, even if your kids are in their 40s, I think this is still a good book to share. Paul Smith, a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
No, I share yours. You're never too old to benefit from parenting with a story. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you. And my guest again, Paul Smith, his book, Parenting with a Story, Real Life Lessons in Character for Parents and Children to Share. You can find more about Paul Smith and his work at leadwithastory.com. And I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Really appreciate you joining us. And if you have comments or questions on today's show, I'm sure you have some thoughts around Frank Schaefer's work, if nothing else, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And you can also email me at info@conversationslive.net. Find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate you spending this hour with us. Until next week, live well, live strong.